Welcome to Transition State.
Cuts through my cheek, I fall into your rust-covered coupe. I don't know what we're gonna do. We'll be right back.
waiting to be strong. No.
Hear me now, hear me now. I was on my mic. That was Electric Youth with Innocence. Before that, we heard the Rural Alberta Advantage, This City, And before that, Death From Above 1979 with their hit Trainwreck 1979. Well, welcome to Transition State. I'm your host as always, Adam Smiley. This week we have a very special guest interview. Earlier this week I sat down with Dr. Peter Lowen, head of the UBC Pharmaceutical Sciences PharmD department, and one of my personal heroes and mentors. So let's hear what he had to say.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Adam.
So I guess we'll get to the Q&A?
Yes.
Okay.
Fire.
What got you started in pharmacy?
A long time ago. I'm trying to think when. Sometime 25 years ago, I think I decided I wanted to be some kind of a healthcare professional. I think at that time, I think I wanted to be either a physician or a pharmacist. I started science, went into pharmacy, liked it, decided to go with it, became a pharmacist. At some point in there, I got inspired to do advanced patient care, clinical practice kind of pharmacy, which at that time wasn't exactly the norm in terms of what the pharmacy profession looked like. So I decided to pursue residency training after my pharmacy degree, which I did at Children's and Women's Hospital. And then that didn't seem to be enough, so I decided to do a postgraduate advanced clinical pharmacy kind of a degree, which at that time it still is called a doctor of pharmacy. So I did. I finished that in like 1996.
And that was all at UBC Vancouver?
Graduated from UBC with my undergrad degree, yeah, and did my residency at Children's and Women's in Vancouver, and then did the UBC Doctor of Pharmacy program, yeah. Yeah. And then
okay.
I've been practicing and teaching and doing research and other things since then.
Okay. Oh, that's a good story. So
thanks.
I imagine you've...
Thanks, it's the only one I have.
In your... in your experience, I'm sure you've been across the country at other universities. Is there anything special about UBC Pharmacy? Like our faculty here?
Yeah, there is. And the community of pharmacists and the way the profession is practiced in BC is very sophisticated and has led the nation for about the last 15 or 18 years in terms of pharmacists, in terms of the number of pharmacists who have attained advanced training and then taken that and created advanced practices. BC's been out front for a long time in that regard, and we continue to be. Ontario, I think, is catching up. And so what that means for our students here is that they get to learn from faculty members. So it's true of the faculty here. However, it's even more true of the associated clinical faculty that our students get a chance to learn from and with when they come and teach about their practice here, and when our students go and spend time on in their experiential rotations. They get exposed to not just outstanding, but sort of leaders on the Canadian scene in many of the areas that our students get to practice and learn in.
Right on. Do you know how Canada fares in the international? Like, do we have a good...
Yeah, Canada has a very good reputation as far as pharmacy practice goes, and I mean that in terms of what's happening in community pharmacy, the changes there in terms of expansion of the scope of practice of pharmacists is ahead of what most Western countries look like in terms of the practice of pharmacy. As far as what I call advanced practice pharmacists, so clinical pharmacists, mostly who work in, let's say, the hospital sector, what's been happening there for the last 15 or so years is considered by many to be the most advanced in the world. And the ways that pharmacists have carved out advanced practices like in cardiology and nephrology and critical care and infectious diseases and neurology and other areas like that are some of the best anywhere. And so,
is there a, this is random, but is there like a Sidney Crosby of Canadian pharmacy? Like, just, oh, he's the best.
Well, we were hoping that you would be that for us.
Sure. I just need a few more years. Okay. Okay, then, if you could change anything about the way we teach pharmacy at UBC, what would it be?
Well, one of my jobs as director of our new entry to practice PharmD program, which starts in September 2015, and which will gradually replace our BSc program, one of my jobs is to change everything about how we teach pharmacists.
Okay.
So, I have easy answers to that.
Everything.
Well, so I'm not being evasive. Our new program, instead of our students having 20 weeks of experiential learning like our current BSc students do, our new PharmD program students will receive 46 weeks of experiential learning by the time they graduate. So that's a profound change in the amount of direct patient care experience that our grads will have by the time they reach that point. And that will make a huge difference in terms of how prepared they are to take on patient care roles and how confident they are and the spectrum, the breadth of settings in which they can go and practice compared to our current program. The other main thing that we are changing is the fact that from the very first year of the program, our students will learn direct patient care, clinical problem solving skills, whereas our current program tends to load that in the second half of the second year and beyond. In our new program, it will start in the first week of the first year, and all of the learning about the pharmaceutical sciences and how to optimize patients' drug therapy, which is what significantly being a pharmacist is all about, our students will learn in an integrated fashion. So we can break down what it takes to build a pharmacist into a whole bunch of components. We've broken it down into 13, and unlike our current program where students have a special course devoted to something like medicinal chemistry or pharmacology and that sort of thing, in our new program they'll learn that all in an integrated way so that they can see the relationships between basic science concepts and knowledge and applications to patient care and patient problem solving in a way more fluid and, we think, practically useful way.
And you think we'll have better pharmacists for it?
Yes. We have to.
Okay, that's a threat on the horizon for me, but okay.
It's not meant as a threat, Adam. There's a way for you to attain all of the skills that our new program will impart.
I'm really interested if you, when you at some point like designed a program like that sort of from scratch or like how to do it, how were you able to measure like what society wants from its pharmacists?
Yeah, good question. Thankfully, we had to do none of that.
Okay.
So the profession of pharmacy about 5 years ago created a statement called the Blueprint for Pharmacy, which I know you know about.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved dozens of stakeholders across Canada, all the pharmacy organizations, the pharmaceutical industry, universities, all the pharmacist societies and professional societies, getting together and tons of public consultation, getting together to create a roadmap for what pharmacists need to be able to do. Sort of a pharmacist of the future thing, but in fact it has very much a flavor of what is needed now. And the work since then has been about how to create pharmacists that can do the things that the public has said pharmacists need to be able to do. So that's the other part of it, is that we know that the public wants pharmacists to do more than what most members of the public are used to their pharmacists doing. And so, which isn't to say that there aren't already many, many pharmacists that can do what might be called advanced kinds of patient care activities. It's just that most members of the public don't encounter them in their everyday life. And so the public, there's been conversations in Canada, formal ones run by provincial governments, with the public about how they want their healthcare system to look and what needs to change. And the public in a program in BC called the Conversation on Health resoundingly said they want to be able to receive their healthcare whenever they want it, whenever they need it, and for it to be provided by anyone who possibly can, and for that, for that whoever is most appropriate to do what needs to be done, that they be able to do that. Which means a whole bunch of things, like the public does not want to sit in a physician's office and wait for an hour to have a 4-minute visit to have a conversation about, let's say, a routine health problem or a monitoring visit and that sort of thing. And it means that people don't want to wait an hour and a half for a prescription to be renewed. Physicians don't want to field calls from pharmacists about whether a prescription can be renewed. All of the reasons why those kinds of inconveniences to the public exist have to do with healthcare professionals being properly prepared and trained to deal with the kinds of problems that are common and important, and then healthcare professionals trusting each other to be able to deliver that care and be accountable to each other and to the public. And then lastly, things like scope of practice laws and laws about who in the healthcare system is allowed to do what. So in the last few years in Canada and BC in particular, we have new legislation that does what the public has said it wants, which is they want to receive their health care more conveniently and from whomever is best equipped to deliver it. And so it's from all of those different, and so that's led to scope of practice changes for pharmacists and for nurses and other healthcare professionals that are in that direction. So it's from all of those angles that we understand what pharmacists need to do, what the public wants pharmacists to do, what the government as an organ of the public needs pharmacists to do within the healthcare system. So we've built an education program that's designed and tuned to do exactly that.
Okay, that makes sense. In a nutshell, the public sort of wanted more, and so we thought of a new system to teach more, and we'll have pharmacists who can do more.
Simple.
Okay, the system works.
Yeah, okay. Sometimes. In this case.
Okay. Let's transition then. So without giving medical advice, this is not any kind of endorsement, but what's your favorite drug?
My favorite drug?
Yeah.
I got a couple personal favorites.
Yeah, I'm on me.
Okay, one of them's ibuprofen. Super useful for that sore throat, you know, that I get a couple times a year. Does the trick for me. Another one, Adam, mm-hmm. Chlorpheniramine. It's an antihistamine.
Okay.
Whenever I get a cold, I get a cough that goes along with that. Want me to talk about my nasal secretions?
No.
So chlorpheniramine helps with that thing that you don't want me to talk about that gives me a cough.
Okay.
Magic. Sleep through the night. Makes me drowsy too.
So antihistamines, first generation antihistamines, they're supposed to act on like the histamine response allergic reaction, right? But this is for a cold?
They're supposed to, but a lot of what they do, like what the Benadryls of the world do is have anticholinergic effects.
Okay.
And so
that dries up your mucus?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they conveniently cause a little bit of sedation as well, which
sleep
is
helps.
Perfect.
Those
are a couple of my faves.
I think I've personally benefited from chlorpheniramine. Okay. It's in Neocitrin?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. You can buy the generic tablets by like the bottle of 200 and keep some of that handy. Good for allergies. Again, I'm not giving advice. I'm talking about my own experience, what I use them for.
Okay.
My favorite drug, those are my personal favorites.
Okay,
favorite drugs in my practice. I work in general medicine, looking after mostly elderly people because that's who presents to the hospital and gets admitted to a general medical unit. I work at Vancouver General Hospital. My two favorites are Ramipril, which is an ACE inhibitor, mm-hmm. as all of your listeners know,
mm-hmm.
and Simvastatin, which is a statin, which your listeners also know.
Anti-cholesterol. Okay, so why Simva and not ATOR?
Yeah, it's a good question. ATOR, like, your listeners know what ATOR is as well.
Atorvastatin, same class.
Okay.
So we're sort of taught that they're sort of equal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They'll say, like, among the class, these have equal efficacy. If anything, I thought I've seen research lean towards atorvastatin.
Yeah, there's lots of good evidence to support atorvastatin. And why do I prefer simvastatin over atorvastatin? My sense is that there is also strong evidence for simvastatin. The two have never been compared head-to-head in such a way that you could definitively say that one is more effective than the other. And they've been compared in similarly large kinds of trials. And simvastatin's traditionally always been cheaper than atorvastatin, although that's no longer true. So I'm giving you a partially evidence-based and partially emotion-based answer, which is what you can always expect of me.
Okay. Do you have a favorite chemical moiety? No?
I'm racking my brain to remember what a chemical moiety is. I feel like maybe I like a Buckminster Fullerene.
Buckminster.
That's probably my fave.
Okay, I'll give you that. And then further down, favorite element.
Yeah, my favorite element, I think, is it's probably going to be silver. It's going to be argentium.
Okay. I might even agree with you on that.
Yeah, what's yours? Oh, you're maybe that's one of yours, one of your top five?
Yes, I would say, without thinking too much, I'd probably go titanium.
Okay, yeah.
But good. Silver.
Yeah, no, titanium, good. It's going to be good for that new exoskeleton that
you're
probably going to need someday. I like that.
Okay, and then
What's Wolverine's skeleton made out of?
Adamantium.
Adamantium, yeah.
There you go, yeah.
A fake element.
Yeah.
But you could... Does that have to be real elements that we name here only?
No,
we can find to that?
Well, yeah, that opens the question of how real is the real element. But, okay, wait. I wanted to play some music. So do you like music? Do you have any musical
love
requests?
Love music.
What would you like to hear right now?
Right this second? Probably Guns by Churches.
Guns by Churches on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm learning.
And we're back. So I'm in the office of Dr. Peter Loewen, and we're talking pharmaceutical science. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Adam.
So now I'd like to clarify some of my thoughts on statistical significance.
Okay.
So you said in class that sort of some of the numbers you put up there were, quote, true. I think I may have been...
You're making scare quotes and pretending to quote me at the same time, and... I'll start by saying I don't remember saying anything was true, but I'll follow along.
Okay. Well, I'm...
What did I say was true?
Well, you had a slide of basically studies and different statins, I think,
mm-hmm.
and then, like, the amount or percentage that they lowered cholesterol by.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think I sort of hinted that maybe it was your opinion that those worked, and you said that this was no opinion, this was a fact.
Okay.
And so one of the studies was SPARKLE,
mm-hmm.
stroke prevention, aggressive reduction in cholesterol levels, compared atorvastatin 10 milligrams to 80 milligrams, secondary prevention?
No, 80 versus placebo in SPARKLE.
Okay.
TNT is atorva 80 versus 10.
Okay, I'm glad I was testing you. I'm glad you caught that.
Which one do you want to talk about?
SPARKLE.
Okay.
So I have, they were comparing atorva 80 to... Placebo. For secondary prevention. So people who've had a stroke. Okay. And so their findings were that atorvastatin did help lower the risk of a further event, but it didn't reduce overall mortality. And their p-value for the difference in reduction in stroke was... Well, they gave an adjusted hazard ratio of 0.084, which was 0.71 to 0.99.
Okay.
And that's a p-value of 0.3.
Mm-hmm.
0.03.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave an unadjusted p-score of 0.05.
Uh-huh.
So when I read that, I thought, that sort of scrapes barely by in terms of statistical significance.
Mm-hmm.
But just because it hits that arbitrary line of 0.05... we round up the rest and call it, quote, fact, or quote, true.
Round up the rest.
We figure, it's 95% likelihood of not
being. We're 95% sure that there's a difference between, colloquially, what we're saying is we're 95% sure that there's a difference between atorvastatin and placebo here in terms of recurrent stroke rates. Yeah, okay. I interrupted you. Then what do you say we say? It's a fact?
Yeah.
Oh.
Does that seem like a bit of a leap? Or that's fine for you? 95% sure is basically fact?
I don't use the word fact. What we're saying is we're 95% confident that atorvastatin is better than placebo.
Okay.
And so... you can attach other words to that if you want to.
No, yeah.
I don't, but...
I'm not trying to. Yeah, okay.
No, I'm not saying you are, but, you know, you might hear a newspaper reporter or anyone else use other language, but strictly speaking, that's... Since we're talking about stats right now, that's all we're saying.
So when you read that study, you thought, convincing.
I think, so we're talking about the Sparkle trial in particular, and I think the Sparkle trial was well done, and so our job as healthcare professionals is always to look at the specifics of a study and how it was done and know what the difference between well done and not well done looks like. So that's called critical appraisal. We look at these things and make judgments about whether they're well done or not. Because the idea is that if a study is well done and produces results that might be potentially applicable to your patient or to your practice, and it's well done, then only then and only then should we contemplate whether we might use that drug or change our practice as a result of that study. So in this case, my sense is that the SPARKLE trial is well done and represents good evidence that atorvastatin would be a useful secondary prevention intervention to give a patient who's had an ischemic stroke.
Okay, then would you say then this trial alone may be not enough to convince you exactly, but combined with other things, other pieces of evidence, adds up to a picture that is convincing?
Yeah, I think that's true in this case and always true.
Okay.
We can nuance that. In this particular case, this is the only randomized controlled trial that's looked at the question of statins for secondary prevention of stroke. So you can look even at your question multiple ways. One way is, well, just based on one trial, why would you believe that a statin or atorvastatin could reduce recurrent ischemic stroke? I mean, you could take a position that that's not enough evidence. What I and most have done as a result of that trial is consider the fact that that result is pretty consistent with what lots of other trials have shown more generally, which is that in patients with other kinds of atherosclerotic related conditions like acute coronary syndromes, so heart attacks and coronary artery disease, that statins reduce the incidence of bad things happening, major adverse coronary events in people like that. And so because this effect on ischemic stroke, which is another atherosclerosis-related phenomenon, is similar to those, that many feel comfortable saying that this trial, this SPARKLE trial, the one and only, is a useful basis on which to adopt use of statins for patients who've had an ischemic stroke.
Okay, that adds up. Okay, I'm not quite sure if... I feel like sometimes a whole bunch of semi-good evidence might not add up to be good evidence. But okay, I'll let that go.
You don't have to let that go. I can...
I really want to touch on something.
You can have a bunch of semi-good evidence, and you can literally add it up. We have a technique for that called meta-analysis.
Statistics, yeah.
No, it's called meta-analysis. Yeah. Like all research, there are statistics involved in how you analyze the data.
Yeah.
And that's true whether you're doing research on diving birds or on humans in medicine. But sometimes a whole bunch of semi-good evidence can be added up and result in your ability to have more confidence about your conclusions than any individual piece of semi-good or weak evidence might allow you to do.
Okay. Indulge me a bit. So I think that once I graduate, I'm going to move to a small town in BC and practice there.
Oh, those people there are so lucky.
And I'm even going... So I'm sort of...
When will you reveal what town it is? So there can be... Will there be a craft sweepstakes in order to figure out which town Adam will go to? Which people will be graced
near
with
Alberta.
His skills?
That's
so not in Alberta,
but
near it.
So
because you wouldn't want to live in Alberta.
I'm going to...
You would.
I need to play like a devil's advocate for like a certain down-home, almost redneck point of view.
You need to?
Yes.
You'd like to.
These are the people that I have to explain
to.
Stuff to.
Okay.
So I'm going to take that role and see if Mr. Mullen knows what to say.
Are you sure you want to do that?
Yeah,
are you sure the people of this unnamed town are going to be comfortable being characterized the way you just characterized them? What is down home?
These are my people.
What does that mean?
I've lived in Alberta for a long time.
Oh.
I'll explain it when you're later. I lived in Alberta long.
Okay. I don't want to make you go so on there the was, about this.
During the World Cup, there was an octopus that was picking winners.
Yeah. Yes, right? I heard about that.
And it picks... Going back to the previous
World Cup... Is this octopus in Germany or something? Some kind of German octopus?
Yeah, sounds right. Okay, yeah. But it was... It picked... Going back to the other World Cup, it ended up picking 12 out of 14 winners.
Right.
P-value 0.01.
Uh-huh.
So do you consider that convincing?
Is that what the p-value associated with? Is that was that like the probability that the octopus could correctly?
If it was just random, randomly picking, the p is 0.01.
Yeah,
which is sort of stricter than the Sparkle trial.
Yeah.
So do you consider that to be the relevant? Like, do you think consider that to be like convincing that octopus can pick winners?
Yeah, that's a great thought experiment. The folks in Alberta, where you will not be practicing because you'll be just on the other side of the border from them.
Close but not too close,
As you lob arguments over the provincial boundary.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't have an opinion on that octopus, but I'll start with it's pretty improbable. Actually, I understand octopi are the most intelligent among the most intelligent sea creatures.
Okay.
So...
Invertebrates?
I don't know. I'm sure they have to be the most intelligent invertebrates. And I understand that many biologists believe them to be among the more intelligent of all species.
Yeah.
So you can look that up.
Okay.
I'll give you that for free.
Okay.
You can cut this all out. Verifiable statement.
But
it's just true.
Right.
Actually, I don't know if that's true or not. So it's possible that this octopus, if he or she, are octopi gendered, or are they an omnisexual creature? Okay, you can look that up too.
Yeah, I'll look that up. Okay.
He or she, if they were sufficiently well read, and had enough access to information on the various football. They call it soccer on the BC Alberta border.
Yeah,
it's called football around the rest of the world.
If
he had sufficient access to results and scores and historical trends and weather patterns and home field advantages and legislation around whether beer and other forms of alcohol could be served in the stands and other kinds of crowd control measures that would affect the degree of audible support that a particular team was able to receive and all of that sort of thing, I have no doubt whatsoever that an octopus would be able to process that in such a way as to reliably predict the outcomes of soccer matches. So that's one thing. Let's presume for a moment that this particular octopus does not have access to that information.
Yes.
So the statistic that you tossed my way, mm-hmm. which I'll just take at face value from a down-home perspective,
right? Yeah.
That's just a true stat. I guess what that is meant to be saying to us is that there's about a 1 in 100 chance that this octopus could have correctly predicted. Would you say 14 matches in a row or something?
12 out of 14.
Could have correctly predicted the results of 12 out of 14 matches, given that the octopus has no ability to successfully predict matches. That's what a p-value means.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a 1 in 100 chance that octopus could have done that,
but
given that he has no soccer predicting ability.
Yeah.
So that's what that means. So when you ask me if something is true or not, or something is significant or not, you ask a question that has no inherent meaning.
Okay.
Do things that have a 1 in 100 probability of happening happen? Yes. Billions and billions and billions of times every single day in every part of the world.
Okay.
That Randy Johnson could throw a baseball in a Major League Baseball game a distance of 60 feet 6 inches and a pigeon could fly by at that moment, at that altitude, at that time,
it happens,
be struck by that ball, the probability of that occurring, given that Randy Johnson has no special pigeon assassinating abilities, is the p-value on that would be around, I don't know, less than 0.00000000000001. Is it true that Randy Johnson hit a pigeon?
Yes. Okay, so we agree then that those things, improbable things, do happen. And that applies equally to pharmaceutical science experiments, RCTs, right?
Yes.
And sometimes the results are just, they just happened.
They're by chance alone, and we even put a number on the probability that that happened by chance alone.
Yeah. And we also agree that it doesn't prove really anything. It doesn't prove that that octopus can really, right?
That's where you lose me. When you turn it into proving or true, then what you're making is
anything about the World Cup. It just does it. It's an octopus.
Right. And yet has a 1 in 100 chance of correctly predicting 12 out of 14 matches. And if where you're going is it possible that a random substance that has no efficacy whatsoever could be studied in a randomized controlled trial and people who got the useless substance do better than people who didn't get the useless substance? Yes. And in fact, that can happen if the p-value is right at the 0.05 level of significance. That would happen in exactly 1 out of 20 times that you ran that trial.
And I have a feeling
that is the whole underpinning purpose and cognitive construct of clinical medicine.
Okay.
So that expression on your face...
Well, I just want to mention one more thing in the last minute. So other than that, beyond all that, there are other, probably, conceivably, other places where they're running similar experiments, right? There's lots of people working at zoos, and they'll give their hamster the chance to pick a World Cup winner, and they end up just being sort of 50-50, and so it's not on the news, it's not reported. These guys, like, sort of there's a selection bias. That also equally applies to modern clinical evidence, right?
That there are randomized controlled trials going on and that they are never reported or published.
The selection bias?
So your first question, yes, there's a thing called publication bias,
okay,
which is the fact that journals tend to publish reports that where an effect was found. They favor those over trials which showed no effect. So that's a reporting kind of a bias. And by definition, as we just said, it's true that if you replicate a clinical trial that's designed to detect an effect at the what we call the 0.05 level, the 1 in 20 level, then 1 out of 20 times that you do that trial, you will, and let's say the therapy is no effect, you'll get a result suggesting that the therapy does have an effect. That's right.
So then, are we being rigorous enough in our demand for good evidence?
Well, what the scientific community has decided is that it wishes to be 95% sure that stuff works. We're talking about interventions we give people. That could be drugs, it could be a surgical procedure. We want to be 95% sure that it works. If it pretty much stops there. You can ask me whether I think 95% sure enough is good enough. I can ask you whether you think 95% is sure enough.
Good question.
All I can say is I know what you think, which is that you're a person who doesn't feel like 95% is good enough.
But nowadays, how many trials get performed in a year in the world?
Thousands.
So shouldn't we at least demand like a level of 0.001, 1,000th, so that only one a year is due justice. It seems so. With 20% of thousands, like hundreds and hundreds of these are just due to statistical aberrations.
Yes, and that is exactly true. And everyone in the scientific community knows that. There are papers written every year about how the fact is that some things that we find, even in the best, using the best technologies we have, the best clinical medicine technology we have is a randomized controlled trial. Using that, because it's designed this way, that we set a certain probability that we're willing to accept that this thing will say, will show a difference, even though there's no difference. And we accept that that probability be 5% or less. And then the answer to your question is we could set that differently. Some trialists do set it more rigorously than that. The consequence of doing that is that you will have to do a sample size calculation that will result in you having to enroll 5 or 10 times as many people in the trial as you otherwise would have, which has profound ethical implications.
We just will get less info, less studies done.
Well, you will do less studies. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars to do a very large RCT. And let's say you're doing a placebo-controlled trial, Adam. If you have to do a 5 times larger trial because you've set your required alpha or p-value at 0.01 instead of 0.05, you probably have to do 10 times as many people. Guess what? If you're randomizing them to active therapy versus placebo, you just now randomize 10 times as many people to placebo.
So no treatment. Okay, there's a dilemma in there. I see. Okay, well, let me stop there. It's my hope that we can continue this discussion in the future.
That would be great.
But for now, I'll let you go. I want to say thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure, Adam. Thank you for inviting me.
So that's it for this week, radio fans. I hope that was an enlightening journey through pharmaceutical jungle world. We got one more track for you. This is Rosie June. Sorry, Rosie. This is Rosie June. Track is Broadway. Until next week, stay pharmaceutically sound.